Well, I know I'm between you and a break, and everybody's probably suffering from post-lunch sleepiness. So hopefully we'll talk about some things that'll keep you interested and awake. And if not, we'll have Jonathan and Chip sing again. Get us all involved. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you a little bit today about some of the resources from the National Library of Medicine that we've done in conjunction with NIEHS and with the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, and how some of these tools that are used by or can help with disaster workers and emergency responders, and how they can either help monitor their own health or provide them with key information that will help help them as they respond to incidents and stay safe and healthy during those incidents. In addition, I'll mention a few reference tools that aren't specific to the subject area but certainly contain a lot of information that could be used to supplement this. So I'm Stacey Arneson. I'm with the National Library of Medicine's Disaster Health Information Program. And our mission is to develop and provide access to health information resources and technology for all phases of disasters. And first, I guess I should check to see how many of you know the National Library of Medicine. Okay, most of you. Is it because you know PubMed? Yep, okay, most people know PubMed. WISER? Do people know WISER? Okay, got a few of those as well. Okay, I just want to make sure. The National Library of Medicine really has probably hundreds of resources out there. Most people know PubMed. Other people know Medline Plus, which is consumer health information. Not so many people know the disaster health resources, or they just know one of them. WISER certainly our most popular, so we're going to go through that. But before I do that, I really want to go back to what Betsy was talking about in terms of the Disaster Research Response Program, and we've been working again with NIEHS very closely on this and working with them to not, you know, they've been collecting a lot of materials, they've been doing the exercises, developing tools and resources, but then how can we make this information available to everybody and anybody who might be interested in just reading about it or actually using it? So we've worked with them to develop the NIH Disaster Research Response website. Sorry, that yellow is not so clear. dr2.nlm for National Library of Medicine, .nih for National Institutes of Health, .gov for you to take a look at what we have. And one of the key things that we've been doing is collecting this sort of database of research tools. What kinds of surveys, questionnaires have been used in previous disasters, how they've been used, what's been published about them, and then make those tools available so that other people could use them rather than reinvent the wheel and say, oh, how many surveys on community resilience after Hurricane Sandy need to be developed, or are there community resiliency tools out there that others can use? So we've been working very closely, of course, with S3. Steve Ramsey is here, and they did a very thorough literature review to find these information tools, and then we included them in a database. So here we just have a simple example, a little hard to read, but we searched for oil, so you could get tools that were involved in oil spills and come up with information about the tool and how it's used or how it was used in a disaster. Who would be able to administer this tool? Is it a short form? Is it a long form? Does a professional need to do it? Can a layperson do it? As well as information on what's been published about it, so the citations that are related to this. So this can be found in this database. In addition, Betsy made reference to RAPID. Let's see if I can get this acronym straight. I might need help, Steve. So the Rapid Acquisition of Pre- and Post-Incident Disaster Data. Did I get that right? study protocol, which was developed to try to, ahead of time, develop a protocol in identifying what kind of data needs to be collected in a disaster. And I think it's very important that this went through the NIEHS IRB and has been given approval to be used in a disaster scenario. And we have the information and the up on the website, so you too can look to see at the RAPID protocol and what's available. And the idea is, I think it's been mentioned a couple of times, is how can we do some of this research faster than we've been able to do it in the past. So how can we start collecting this baseline data sooner rather than later, that in some of the previous incidents, it's been 9 months before data been able to be collected and you've missed all that baseline data. So how working with the workers, with the communities, for them to understand why we're doing this, which is really to try to help protect them and ensure their health and safety, and try to get this information sooner rather than later, and as well as exploring ways in which we can try to get funding available out there sooner rather than later, and starting to do a little bit of that as well. The other thing that we're working on that, again, Steve has been very instrumental in is how can we get these surveys and tools that are out there and in the public domain. Some of them are private, been developed by private organizations, are not necessarily in the public domain for us to use or there'd be a fee. But the ones that are in the public domain, can we get them in a format that others can use easily? So we've been working on using the CDC EpiInfo tool to try to get some of these surveys into EpiInfo so that people can use them and start collecting data. And so EpiInfo does have a nice interface in which you can create your own survey and start entering data and collect the data, analyze the data, in some cases even do GIS mapping of that data. So here's a form builder example where you can start putting in your information and building the survey tool. You can also see that it's available on mobile devices here. So you've got EpiInfo. We have an example here looking at, they're trying to ask some questions about your home and if you feel safe in your home after a hurricane, what some of the issues were. But anything, you can really put any kinds of questions in there. There's the possibility if there are multiple surveys that you're interested in, but there might be questions from one survey or another survey, that you might be able to pick and choose and build a new survey form that could be used. And again, the advantage of being able to collect and analyze this data with the EpiInfo tool is very, very important, because that's can be a great to have a Word or PDF document of the survey, but it's another thing to be able to administer it, collect the data, and analyze it as well. Now I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit more about NLM's resources that are available for emergency responders and the disaster workforce. To start with, I'm going to mention our homepage for our Disaster Health Information Program, which is disasterinfo.nlm.nih.gov. Again, I see it's a little hard to read in the yellow down there, where we have our information toolkit that will point you to the website I just talked about, as well as to many other tools and resources to get you started. And we do have some handouts in the back, and if they're out at the session, please come up to the NLM booth, 1921, or the NIEHS booth, which is 1320-something. There's not that many. You'll find it there, and we'll have those handouts available there as well. So I'm going to talk about some of the threat-specific resources that we have, WISER, CHEM, and REM. These are tools that are designed for hazardous materials, hazmat, or CBRN, chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear incidents. So what kind of information do we have in WISER and CHEM? WISER, our URL, wiser.nlm.nih.gov, and CHEM, CHEM with two M's, Chemical Hazards Emergency Medical Management.nlm.nih.gov. Well, we have information on over 400 chemicals, over 20 radiologic agents, as well as the CDC Category A biologic agents, including Ebola and other hemorrhagic diseases. We have a variety of tools and reference materials in there, along with triage algorithms, the emergency response guidebook that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, the weapons of mass destruction guidebook, radiation procedures, and information from CHEM on mass casualty chemical incidents. In addition, with WISER and CHEM, we do have decision support tools available. So if you're dealing with an incident where you don't know what the chemical is, that there are two different ways that you can work on identifying what the chemical might be. What kinds of platforms are WISER and CHEM found on? Well, we do have a Windows-based version. That might seem a little old-fashioned. It's kind of interesting. With WISER, we actually started with PDAs way back in 2004. And emergency responders said, oh, that's really great, we really love it, but most of us don't have PDAs, but many of us have a laptop in the fire trucks and ambulances, so we went to the Windows version, and it's still a fairly popular platform. We also have web versions of Wiser and Chem. And then what we did, we integrated Chem and Wiser into the mobile application field for iOS, so iPhones and iPads, the Android, and also we have version for BlackBerry, which is really just using the web version there. The idea is that for most of the features, the Windows and the iOS and Android platforms don't require any cell service or Wi-Fi service. The data is stored on your device. Very important since you might not have connectivity in a disaster. So just trying to think about how these tools might be used. A chemical truck is overturned on the highway, spilling a liquid, driver's trapped in the truck, can't see what the placard is, or maybe you can, but it's a little, you know, it's all hard to get to. Emergency responders on their are on their way. What kind of information do they need to know? Hospitals receiving patients, what do they need to know? Well, some of the things that you need to know immediately really do revolve around the safety of the workers, of those emergency responders, because they're not going to be able to, as we all know, they're not going to be able to provide much help unless they themselves are protected. So they can't get into harm's way and provide any help for folks unless they're protected. So they would need to know what kind of PPE they would need to wear, what the fire potential, firefighting procedures, are the reactions with other chemicals that might be around there. Do they need to evacuate the area? So what kinds of things do they need to think about, not only themselves as workers, but also the community, as well as then how are they going to provide treatment to those folks, whether at the scene or then at the hospital. So as I mentioned, Wiser and Chem have chemical decision support tools to help you identify what a chemical might be. With Wiser, you can use signs and symptoms. You can see here, you have a nice little body. You can click on a body part and then identify what might be. So you click on the brain, it might be dizziness, it might be altered consciousness. It could be a number of different things. Click on the heart, you can have irregular heartbeat, hypertension, whatever. You can select those and it'll start narrowing down what the chemicals could possibly be. You can also put in properties. If you know it's a liquid, if you know the color, does it have a smell? Do you know something about the placard that's on the, in this case it was a truck, it could be a rail car, do you have any information on that that would help identify it? On the other hand, Chem is more designed for mass casualty incidents, and this is trying to take a look at a series of symptoms that would lead to what we call a toxidrome. So not necessarily an individual chemical that they're trying to identify, but a class of chemicals that has a certain kinds of symptoms. So Chem is often used right now in terms of if we think it might be a terrorist incident, that kind of thing. So you answer a series of questions, pinpoint pupils, so the person having seizures, cardiac signs, et cetera, and then it gives a weighting system as to what kind of syndrome it could be. In this case, it's looking like it's pesticide syndrome. It might be a little hard to see in the back of the room. Well, pesticides, meaning it could be organophosphorus pesticide or nerve agent, such as sarin. I remember I think it was 95, the sarin gas attack in Tokyo, a tool like this would have been helpful in identifying what that might be. Once you have information on what chemical it might be, what kind of information can you get? You can see here the kinds of information we have, basic identification, personal protective equipment, clinical symptoms, treatment, et cetera, et cetera. We'll give some key information. We're looking at ammonia here. The idea is that immediately you'd want people to know the very first thing that this is a corrosive toxic chemical, that it could be fatal if inhaled. Then you can go through and decide what additional information as emergency responder you might want to see here. Since we're talking about worker safety, we want to take a look at those kinds of information, so information from the National Fire Protection Association, what personal protective equipment should you wear if you're working with ammonia, and I think I mentioned the protective distance. This is the one feature on Wiser and Chem that requires connectivity in order to get the map, but you're able to put in, this is not, this is kind of a quick and dirty put in wind direction, and it's going to give you the distance that you need to be concerned about and could help you map out the area in which would be affected by this particular chemical. And then once the workers are protected, they've got things under control, then they can provide the medical treatment to those who have been exposed. And so we have basic treatment information. We get this from Trubin Health. Acute care, medical care comes in from Chem that we've worked with a number of different agencies, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness Response, and several other NIH institutes to get that information for Chem. In addition, we also have cleanup and disposal and environmental health and environmental information in Wiser. So after the fact, workers are coming in, they need to clean up that mess that's on the highway. How do they clean that? How do they keep themselves safe while they're cleaning it up? What environmental impacts that it might have? On a roadway, it might not be very long term, but if it was something that's spilled into a river, it's spilled into the ground, there might be other issues, and all this information can be found here. Just so you know, we also work with the Department of Transportation on the Emergency Response Guidebook. That is available in app form. And much of the information is in WISER, but it's also a separate app. Moving along to REM, the Radiation Emergency Medical Management, this is a tool that helps with radiation incidents. It helps provide guidance and treatment information for healthcare providers. Many healthcare providers don't have much experience, knock on wood, with radiation incidents or radiation injury. So this is a tool that'll help walk them through how do you recognize a radiation incident? Is it contamination or exposure? Now that I know that, what do I do and how do I do it? And it really has very step-by-step guidance to work through it. And it also includes a number of tools to help estimate what dosage somebody might have been exposed to and then what kind of treatment you would provide after that. We recently redesigned REM, so if people have seen it before and it looks a little bit different, just a couple weeks ago we relaunched a redesign of the REM website. Kinds of things you'll see in here, in addition to sort of the step-by-step guidance on diagnosis and treatment, there's a whole host of information on basic radiation information, including animations, which you might say if we go this way again and we can see the animation again, trying to show you how a little bit of shielding can really protect you from radiation contamination there, flow charts for the diagnosis and treatment information, as well as emergency contact information in your community. Also available as a mobile app, as you can see here. Not all of the information is on the app. In some cases, it may refer you back to the website. So some of it's local, some of it might require connectivity. Back to our information toolkit. I want to mention a couple of tools that are much more general than the ones that I talked about, but do have information covering worker safety. And if anybody's been following the APHA 15 Twitter, I've been sitting here tweeting about some of these some of these resources and tools and where you might be able to get more information, because some of the tools that were mentioned are in our databases. Some of them I think I need to check on to make sure they get in our database, and also to find additional information. So some of the mental health tools, we have a lot of mental health resources in there, as well as the NIEHS ones that people might want to take a look at. So I think we all know PubMed, or most of us know PubMed or Medline, which is the biomedical journal literature references. But what about all that material that doesn't get into PubMed? And particularly in the area of disaster and emergency response, there's an awful lot of material that doesn't get in there. Reports from NGOs, reports from the federal government. Where does that information go? Well, yeah, I suppose you can find it in Google along with a lot of other junky things or things that they're trying to sell you. Well, we've created a database called DisasterLit to collect all of those kinds of things that don't go into PubMed. So disasterlit.nlm.nih.gov to find this material. This some of the examples of the kinds of materials you'll find in DisasterLit, anything from hearings, anything from training materials, provider resilience right there, videos from ASPR, information from FDA on medical devices, a whole host of kinds of things from not just government agencies, but from a wide range of organizations. I think we have about 700 or 800 organizations represented in about 9,000 resources. We also produce some topic guides or subject guides on key areas such as coping with disasters, in terms of talking about the mental health earlier, coping with disasters, violence, and traumatic events, where we've tried to pull together a number of key authoritative resources for you ahead of time. So you can look at that in mass gatherings. And then we do some that are specific to particular incidents like Hurricane Sandy or Ebola or some of these things. I do want to mention Ebola. I think it was mentioned, some of you may have been in this morning session with Chip and others talking about biosafety and again worker training on biosafety. And this is just a list of the resources NLM alone has on Ebola, so you know how much is out there. So anything from, we have a topic page on it, to information in PubMed, information in DisasterLit, consumer health information in Medline Plus, virus variation information, clinical trials on Ebola, quite a lot. So what we did was we tried to organize all of that information, plus information from other key resources, government agencies, international organizations, into an Ebola outbreak page. So we have that with a lot of information that can help you. In Disaster Lit, we've collected now, I think it's close to 900 resources on Ebola. You can easily refine your search if you just wanted training materials, you just wanted CDC or WHO materials. You can easily do your Amazon kind of shopping over here with the, selecting where the what the source was, what the type of publication was, etc. So just an example, then it would point you to the information that you needed, but you could certainly find just biosafety training resources for Ebola or other highly infectious diseases. And of course, links to PubMed as well for the journal literature. Just as a side note, as working in a library, it's kind of interesting that in reality, all the key information that was coming out first didn't go into PubMed. It takes a long time to do a research study, get it published, etc. So all that information was really what we call the gray literature. So we were collecting and organizing it in DisasterLit, and now you're starting to see the research papers come out in PubMed. But all of that guidance from WHO, CDC, etc., that none of that is ever going to make it into to PubMed. So that's why we do have the other resources available. Then I just want to mention something that we've been doing that's kind of fun and interesting, and I know NIEHS is starting to take a look at that too, is using virtual reality for worker training. So you don't always have the opportunity to practice things. And we heard about this morning about Ebola. We didn't have lots of PPE just to keep using and reusing and that. So how can you do it? So we're looking at using training in virtual reality, open source platforms like Second Life, other platforms like OpenSim, or some private ones like Unity, where you have an avatar, and you become the avatar, and you can practice putting things on, taking things off. And you can have, just like in a disaster exercise, you can have injects where all of a sudden, does the person who's putting on the equipment notice that there's a problem with it? Did they notice that there was a rip in it? Did they notice that their boot wasn't pulled up all the way? And then we're working on that you can then develop into a scoring mechanism. So they're not actually physically doing it, but it's more than just memorizing the steps and listening to a lecture, so they can practice it, so they can do it. We'd really like to get into more immersive environments. I don't know if any of you have had the opportunity to try on Oculus Rift goggles, where you're not just watching it from afar, but you actually feel like you're in the room. You'd actually feel like you were trying on the equipment. So that's just some research area that we're exploring right now. Just want to remind you that Medline Plus has consumer health information, so if you're trying to provide information for workers who aren't emergency responders, aren't that savvy about health and safety information, this is the non-technical material that you might want to provide to them, and it has a whole host of resources on disasters. Most people think it has diseases, but it also has a variety of other topics as well. Just another cool app that we're working on is on family reunifications, way of collecting data very quickly in the field about people who have been lost or found. This could be used in a hospital, in a medical field shelter, as people come in, that you can take their picture, store information locally when you have connectivity, upload it to either a public or a private website, depending on how you're doing it. And then people can search for people that and find out if they, you can either report someone's been missing, or here it could be used as a way to just report people who have been found and are in a particular location, and then others can get that information. And then one of the last things I want to mention is the idea of a go bag. How many of you have your go bag that you deploy with? All right, well, I was hoping for a few more hands there. How many know they're supposed to have a go bag if they're in this? Okay. So the kinds of things that you would put in here, safety items, communication, hygiene, medical supplies, tools, food, etc. But what about a digital go bag? Do all of you have apps on your phones, on your tablets, that might help you in times of a disaster? And this is another good thing to do with worker resiliency, is information that they can have ahead of time, take a look at, know how to use, and store some resources. So we have a web page, and there might be, still be some handouts in the back there, that have a variety of apps that you might want to download to your device. So we do have a number of mental health and psychological apps that have been listed for provider resilience, psychological first aid, etc. I think we have probably 5 or 6 that are listed. Again, that might be good for workers to download ahead of time. And again, one of the things that we do recommend is that people take a look at them ahead of time, and also, is this, where is this information located? There's the idea of standalone, or native apps, or ones that require connectivity. And that's very important in disasters, as I mentioned earlier with WISER, that if you have no connectivity, some of that data might not be available at all. Some of it is a standalone, and it's residing on your mobile device at all times, and so that is something that you could use in a disaster despite connectivity. Of course, you have to have your phone charged. We know that issue as well, but again, there are ways to help with that too. So finally, I just want to mention there's ways to keep up to date with what we have. We have a Twitter account. We also have email updates that we can set. We have email updates that we send periodic news and announcements, as well as information. You can get weekly updates about what we add to our disaster alert database if you're interested in that. And then I just want to thank Cindy Love at Equal Bennett, who couldn't be here today, so I was the lucky one who got to do the presentation. So thank you very much.
Wow, that's a lot. So we have time for some questions. Chip, why don't you come back on up, and we can field some questions and talk about the issues that we kind of laid out here today, which was really how do we not only respond acutely to situations, but longitudinally, and thinking about how do we do this in more innovative ways. I mean, the issue that we've been faced with for decades now is we don't get good information from a lot of these situations. We've been learning slowly, as Marsha McNutt said, for the USGS on earthquakes. They spend about 30, 40 years waiting for each earthquake and getting a little bit of information that after all that time, because they weren't collecting it strategically, they were able to use some of that to start changing the U.S. policies and the way we structure buildings and structures in the country to be more resilient. And we need to do this. We need to do this more thoughtfully. We need to be cognizant of not only the physical health and the mental health effects, but also the efficacy of which we try to respond and what we do about our situations and responses to make them better and understand what we're doing. You know, the World Trade Center was a good example. If we hadn't collected that information and understanding all these first responders were really being impacted, we wouldn't be changing a lot of the way we do things. And so with that, why don't we open it up to questions.
I have a question going back to Jonathan's presentation. Yeah. You mentioned some of the potential negative implications for employers of stressed out employees, workers, and I was wondering, who the heck are these employers? My impression of the cleanup workers in particular, besides volunteers, is that the basic wage temp workers in a lot of ways, and that the employers are contractors who, in the best of situations, don't have a long-term interest in the health and well-being of the employees. Am I wrong about that, or is that a complication in some of the...
No, and it's interesting to tie together the earlier discussions that we had about temp workers. And I think the other thing that's really striking is volunteers, however you want to consider what that means. And I think what we really stepped into, Louise, is, you know, like with AmeriCorps, with FEMA, with the Red Cross, with all these organizations, they don't treat or consider their people to be their employees, nor do they have programs to support them. So in a sense, they're even worse off than temporary worker. Or no. Contractors. So
but who are the employers?
What?
Well, who are
the FEMA General Counsel actually has it out, this question that you raised about employer responsibility when people aren't employees.
Okay. Well, let me address it.
The
problem with the question is that there's so many different types of employers, but the thing that Chip was referring to, there was a study that Baruch College did together with the National Day Laborers Endelon. Organizing Endelon organization. And what happened in Sandy is they always hired people, the contractors, on street corners. Well, it doubled or tripled the number of people that were getting hired on street corners. And what the study with Endelon showed was that these contractors often weren't paying people what they promised, weren't providing respirators, personal protective equipment. If the workers protested, they would get dumped 20, 25 miles from home, you know, at a disaster site. And so they often were relying on their organizations, you know, like Make the Road New York, you know, to provide them with personal protective equipment. That's just one example. The volunteer organizations, I think, you know, that's another dilemma, because you've got all these religious groups like the Presbyterian Disaster Relief, the Six, the Baptists. I mean, every denomination has a disaster program, and they're coming in sometimes for a day, sometimes for a week or more, and they're being deployed by these volunteer organizations. So we were trying to, you know, they're not covered by OSHA, and but we were trying to get the volunteer organizations to adopt OSHA and beyond in that situation. You also have some better situations. You have some unions, like the Laborers International Union, that provides 80 hours of HAZWOPER training to its members in the, what's the name of the group that Sean has?
Yeah,
the
Mason.
Yeah, the and so, you know, but, you know, it gets very complicated. There's also public employers that were doing disaster work, and they're, you know, in New York State, there's a public employee OSHA program, but in half of the states, there's no OSHA protection for public employees. And, you know, my experience is even with public employee OSHA coverage, a lot of the public employers aren't always doing what they're supposed to be doing. So one other last point, another example, the federal government, the Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor provided, I forget if it was $15 million to hire unemployed people to do debris removal for localities. And they weren't being provided safety and health training. And, you know, the people at OSHA, which is also under USDOL, were like not necessarily able to influence the people in this employment, I forget the name of it, this employment grant.
Employment
and Training Administration that was doing these grants. So there's lots of gaps out there. And, you know, the stresses are, you know, we need to start extending our influence to these organizations and helping them to, you know, get into the, what century are we in? 21st century.
By the 22nd, hopefully.
Other questions?
So how is NIEHS working with FEMA, since FEMA's on the ground and working with all these volunteers? Are they listening to you at all?
So, you know, it's a great question, because it's kind of, and, you know, FEMA's kind of set up under the Stafford Act to do this acute response piece of it, right? And they have kind of this feeling, you know, that they're limited, but yet now we have the recovery side of the act, and that really kicked in for Superstorm Sandy, and they actually did provide, you know, funding to CDC, NIOSH, and ASPR, and us, to try to do and look at some of these issues. So they're interested, and they get that, they have to get information, and they have to get good information. So they're interested in a number of these issues now. They're just still kind of reticent about how they get there in terms of process and system. But there's not only HHS at the table, but there's a number of other departments. We've been working with Department of Interior, who has a science support group, and they've been working on things, and they were working with HUD and Hurricane Sandy as well, and provided a lot of energy to start addressing some of these things. So I think there's starting to be a collection and constellation from the federal agencies that we need to do this, we need to move forward, we need to figure out ways to make it work. But under the current kind of funding schemes and regulatory schemes, we're not quite there yet. I mean, we have a vision of, you know, we need a national framework. We need to not only, you know, have our acute response, you know, make sure that we get out there with our acute responders, but also be able to strategically come together, us and the Earth Science Agency, with EPA and others, to get health data, to get environmental data, to get it timely, and to get it in a way that's thoughtful and integrated. And that's where we need to go. So that's really what we're pushing.
Back to this morning's discussion that Deej brought up about the incident command. Yeah. When you think about where you have a public health problem at the center of it, and then supposedly these FEMA people, or FEMA partners, but they're the decision makers, and then public health way over here, you know, it's like,
And when the situations have been happening, all the agencies are doing this. We're all sitting in the, you know, people in the back room going, what do we know about this? You know, we're looking through, what do we know about this substance? Like 80,000 chemicals have almost no data on them. We had that Elk River chemical spill, and everybody's going, well, we got nothing. And the public had as much as we had, you know, the five animal studies, and everybody's looking at the same thing going, you don't really know what you got here. And we don't. And that's, we need need answers and we need to do it better.
And to expand on Chip's point, with the hurricanes and with climate change, we're seeing more and more of these events. You know, the amount of territory affected was massive, and the number of homes that were affected was massive. And what we saw on the ground, you know, Louise and I and others, was there was no incident command. It was a free-for-all, and there were a lot more community groups that were just kind of spontaneously springing up, yellow boots and
Occupy Sandy.
And, you know, FEMA really didn't have an influence on them. I mean, there was an organizational forum, which was the VOADS, which stands for Volunteer Organizations Active in Disaster.
Right.
And all these organizations, including FEMA and the public health organizations, you know, would meet and kind of strategize and share and discuss. But, you know, it didn't penetrate the way it should. And I think the point is that in a situation like that, you're not going to have a military-style incident command. You know, what you really need is people on the ground that are going to help you problem solve, which is what we tried to do with the health and safety training. You know, NIHS allowed the grantees to redeploy some of their funding to do training on the ground.
And I think what Betsy said before too, when we went to the state, you know, California has great resources, and said, okay, here's a situation. You had a problem in the port of LA, and there's, you know, toxic substances, and by the way, it's a gamish, so it's all, you know, it's all sorts of chemicals and things together, so we don't have great information about what's there. And he said, well, we can't do it. It was interesting when they turned to their EPI people and they basically said, you know, we're interested in getting that kind of information. We know we're going to need to know, because everybody's going to ask, is it safe? You know, what do we need to know from a community standpoint and from a worker standpoint? And they basically said, we can't do it. So, but they can work with others that they haven't traditionally worked with. We've been stovepiping our academic community and their partnerships and our unions and others and the worker community apart from the disaster response system. And by doing so, we've created a system that's relying on a top-down approach that can't succeed without really being connected and also answering the questions that are of concern down here. We blow our credibility every time when the federal government comes marching in and the people want to know this and we're answering a different question. Or we pretend like we know, have an answer for something that we don't. Ebola was complicated. All these situations have complicated things, and we can do better. And, you know, there's only one way to do it.
Training people and figuring out who to train on what, when. And the one good thing out of Ebola was that it got a lot of focus on that, and focus on what your supply chain looks like and what, you know, getting a grip on that. So it's been a good outcome. But what I think of is in 24 months, what is the training situation going to look like, and how do we rapidly be able to do either refresher or first-time training for people in response to, you know, I'm thinking of an infectious disease, but in any setting, like how do we have sort of a how-to precautions training in a can that we can really start using on a mass scale if needed? And I don't, because in our world, we don't have that.
Yeah.
A little bit, but we don't have it as like, really, you could deploy this across an entire organization, hundreds of thousands of employees, right?
And Chip has mentioned earlier today that, you know, this effort of trying to look at what training was really out there was really a mess of what's available, especially on infectious diseases, and to, you know, looking at it, it's been run by the kind of the hospital infectious, as you said, Jonathan, hospital infection control people, and very limited to first few groups. And really, how do we create an infrastructure that's sustained and that's consistent, and that's really been the challenge. I think, Jonathan, you talked to this morning.
My answer is we need an OSHA infectious disease standard, because if you look at what changes cultures, you know, take a look at HAZWOP. Employers, Republicans, Democrats, everybody loves NIHS, you know, grant-funded training, because there's an OSHA standard mandating it. You have to do it. We need the same type of mandate in healthcare around infectious disease training. You know, then we wouldn't end up with the dilemma that we have, which is, you know, 12 months after the disaster, everybody forgets about it and moves on to something else. And the culture in healthcare is all based on telemed. You know, they tell the nurses and the aides, you know, you're working your 12-hour shift on your 20-minute lunch break, look up at the TV screen and get your Ebola training. And it's really not effective. And I think an enforceable OSHA standard that requires, a qualified person and interaction, you know, is what we need.
On the research resources, do you have information on research on PPE? Because that's one of the big challenges we have for infectious diseases. The PPE is so clunky and so fraught with errors being made. And I know there are certain academic institutions that are grasped by our public health care, like an engineer designing PPE and testing it. Is there anything like that on the disaster page yet about updates on PPE research?
I'd actually have to go in and research to see if there was work on research. There may be things in PubMed that people have published on. I don't know so much that there is in disaster lit, but again, I have to take a closer look. So that's a very good question, because a lot of what was coming out of CDC and WHO were just guidelines on doing things, but not anything on what your question is.
Right.
Well, how do we know how well they work?
Is there any possibilities?
Go ahead.
I do know there's been underway at a different NIH institute focused primarily on pediatric healthcare providers, and if the clunkiness of the PPE would limit or should limit intervening, different activities. But I know that's just getting started. The last time we had a call, so it might be some time. But I know that's the only thing that channel something to get developed.
I mean, also, Jim Remington is on this interagency board.
IAB, yeah.
And you can go on the interagency board website, and they're kind of addressing these issues. In fact, they came up with a pretty good document around Ebola. And, you know, it was a mixture of different federal agencies and partners, right?
Yeah, that's the most advanced document on PPE related to Ebola infectious disease from IAB.
So much related to that is having one of the obstacles in Ebola was that the PPE was so difficult to put on correctly and remove without self contamination.
Yeah.
And it's clear there needs to be better designs of PPE that are done with infectious disease in mind and not the current state of them. And are you involved in any of that, or is there a movement? Because there was a little bit of that right during the crisis in the fall. But is there anything moving on that?
Well, NIOSH has I forget what it's called, but it's a lab that focuses on evaluating PPE. But also, I believe it's ASPR that funded John Topkins and others. I don't know how much funding it is, but there is funding out there to develop. And there, like Daryl said, we looked at the website. It was engineers and health people. And, you know, they developed a better, suit. And, I think AFT and others are talking about trying to, connect with them, in the spirit of June Edwards, June Edwards is Syracuse. June Fisher, connecting the engineers with the workers, I think is something that we should be really pushing.
Yeah. There's another question right here.
Well, maybe the comment about PPE, and PPE might provide us with too much instead of too little, because we know that PPE provides false sense of security.
Right.
If you do not know how to use it, you can really think that you are using it properly, so it might cause a lot of damage in situational disaster preparedness where you have people which are not trained suddenly using the PPE.
No,
And that goes to the question you said about also using it under the real world conditions. I mean, when they were doing it in Africa, they had to switch people out very continuously and have these work shift and rest cycles and having an incredible amount of manpower to be able to keep up with that, that hospitals are not prepared to do and understand, you know, what really needs to be vigilant, to wear it under difficult conditions, to be able to treat a pediatric or other patients. And, you know, so one thing to be trained on using something, but also to be trained for those conditions under which you're going to operate. That's it. I want to thank everybody for coming today. Thank you.